Okay.
Well, that was an exciting beginning. So now we'll go on to this. I'm Ingrid Lundquist, and I'm here with my dad, Reverend Dr. Charles Lundquist. Yeah. And do you want to just say a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Chuck Lundquist, okay. And I was born in 1928 and November 6th. Retired Lutheran clergyman, mm-hmm. although I don't do too much now. I was active for pretty close to 6 years.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this whole concept of a faith journey and faith formation and a faith journey.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And how yours started at Old Salem in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, the old Swedish Lutheran Church. So tell me about that.
Well, it started out with even before that, with my dad and mom. Mm-hmm. And they're the basic people that have formed and formulated what I believe. And what I have grown to do over the years is really deepen that which they gave to me at the beginning. And so I started at home, but every Sunday, and we had to be at Sunday school and church, and my dad always used to tell me when I was in high school, I don't care how late you're out on Saturday night, you're going to Sunday school and church tomorrow. And so I did, and that's about it. So I started very elementary, believing in God and the Christ that God has sent. And so I got to know a little bit about that from an elementary point of view. And as I grew older, I added different facets to that faith. And it develops and it continues to develop now, by the way. And when I went to college, I faced a different form of people challenging that faith and supporting that faith. And so then when I went to seminary, they did the same thing, only they rebuilt what they tore down more than what they had done in college and high school. Going to seminary was what we did in preparation for the arduous task of being a minister of a congregation, although not all of our class, which is 80 by number, by the way, and although that number was always probably the largest in the history of the Lutheran Church. And that was 60 years ago, and there are about 29 now, that 80 still alive. But we kept on growing and developing so that we could handle the parish primarily. But we have had people that have gone on to be bishops, have gone on to be theological seminary professors, people that have gone on to foreign mission fields. Mm-hmm. So we were trained for a variety of things, but primarily the parish. And we continue to work on it even through the years of which I was 60 now. Mm-hmm. We've continued through that and continue today to keep busy at it, even though we don't practice it officially, doing the doing the work with people in the parish. Still deal with people. As one of my roommates says, it makes any difference where you go. You are still going to be ordained clergyman. Therefore, you will have responsibilities. So, that's what the to be continued is what our whole thing is all about. So that's what we're talking about.
So you grew up in a unique Swedish Lutheran congregation.
Yeah.
Lots of immigrants, yes?
Oh, yeah. And the only one in town like that, a small group of immigrants. And this group, known as the Augustana Lutheran Church, developed pretty much along the lines of the language of the people. And so the people needed a hospital, we built one. Mm-hmm. Needed a seminary, we built one. Colleges, we built one. So that was pretty much a language-oriented thing of Swedish. Now there were other ones in it, but these are the ones that we remembered, were the ones working with it.
Okay.
So.
So what made you discern your call? Because you were a chemistry major in college.
Yeah, right.
And you had plans for medical school.
Yeah, I had plans for it, but they didn't have plans for me at that. So basically what happened was that I had talked to a clergyman in the city of Gettysburg, because that's mm-hmm. where I went to college, and I talked to him about different kinds of carrying out your ministry. And I thought I would be a physician to begin with, because that would be the simplest way I could carry out my faith and share it. But then I learned out that because I was not cut out for the ministry and didn't feel as though I would ever be worthy of being a pastor. But it worked out kind of differently to me that I went on, and I, like that fellow told me, was try it 1 year. You're young enough, mm-hmm. but try it 1 year. And if that does okay, then continue on. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, be man enough to say no and back out.
Why did you think you weren't fit for the ministry?
Well, I wasn't pious enough in the first place, and in the second place, I liked something the sciences. I liked mm-hmm. them better, but it turned out that I found that more interestingly the following of philosophy and. Ethics and all that sort of thing was more in my field than the sciences were, and therefore I would be educationally more fitted for ministry.
Okay.
So,
well, story has it that you couldn't get into seminary because you didn't have enough social sciences.
That's true.
And you had to go to summer school.
I went to summer school to take my, not physical sciences, but economics and sociology and psychology and social sciences.
Social sciences.
Didn't have enough of them.
Okay.
And so I finished that up in order that I could then go on into seminary.
And
we took that in the seminary. We were not admitted to be anything but a candidate for the first year. After the first year, then they matriculated us. And we did the second, third, and fourth years as matriculated students.
So you're like on a trial run the first
exactly
year.
That's exactly right, yeah. We were a candidate for matriculation.
Well, then how did they decide, you decide that you could now be a matriculant?
Oh, that was basically It was in two ways, as I look back on it now. First of all, was the academic. Mm-hmm. You had to do that. You had to pass your courses, you know. But secondly, they would kind of watch you a little bit to see whether or not you were developing in your faith.
Okay.
As to whether or not you would be in that class worthy of it. So they watch you through all 4 years very carefully. Mm-hmm. And they administered, they candidates a discussion with them on four different occasions. And you had to pass each of those, four of those, in order to be a candidate for, or to be matriculated.
Okay.
And apparently I made it.
You made the cut.
Yeah, I made the cut.
So
yeah.
Talk about your third year in seminary in Minneapolis.
Oh, that was a, yeah. Well, the since 1936, the Augustana Lutheran Church sent all candidates for ministry on what they called an intern year. Mm-hmm. And you sent that year either a September appointment or an August appointment. Mm-hmm. And I had a September one. And you spent the whole year in a parish learning what the parish did. And I was sent to Minneapolis, Minnesota, in order to do that. So those worked out very well. You learned a little bit more of what was required of a parish pastor. And one that was most important was to see how you got along with the people. And when you came back in for your senior year, I've noticed that the ones that were teaching us always preferred to see the seniors as their people because they knew what questions to ask. They knew how to look at that sort of thing, yeah. So, but the most important thing of this was I met my future wife in Minneapolis, and that was called getting the most out of your internship, and indeed I did. She moved back to Rock Island, Illinois, where our seminary was for my senior year, mm-hmm. and she had worked as an x-ray technician in East Moline while I was finishing up in seminary. And then when they finally decided as to when it would be, which was June 20th, and it would be in Los Angeles, California.
Your ordination.
Ordination would right. be then. Then we set our wedding date to be back on June the 12th, so we got out of there and could run all the way then to Minneapolis, okay. Los Angeles.
So since you brought up Mom.
Yeah, right.
How did she play, what's her role did she play
well,
in your ministry?
She made a primary role in the ministry, as one baseball lion said, today I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. Well, he was not the only one, I was too. And basically, Eileen was, by the way, it was her name, Eileen, and she was one who supported me in everything that I did, and and gave me suggestions as to what I should do and what I should not do. But there was one who upheld and supported me in everything. I kid a lot. when I talk about Eileen, and I said that was such a thing as heredity and heredity. And I really mean that when I talked about Eileen with her kids and in her work with them, that was heredity, because I was gone a lot. Mm-hmm. I was gone a tremendous amount of time, but she took care of the rearing of the kids and bringing them along the ways that they should go. So that was one thing that I wanted to make absolutely sure, that she was a helpmeet in all sorts of ways. No way would I have done the things that I did anything of that sort had it not been for her. And so that's a little bit about her supportive ministry. That and it was a ministry, that's for sure. So,
yeah. Anyway. So you did do a lot of things in the community, and things have changed so with pastors and churches and how they interact with the community. I mean, what did you choose to do? Why did you choose to be involved with the community? And what do you see going on now?
Well, there were two guiding principles when I came to the become pastor at Bethel Lutheran in Boardman. The two guiding principles were, one, to work with the congregation, work in ways they needed, and wherever they were, and then cause it to grow. And then the second thing was the ecumenical work that happened within the life of the church. So the first was, there was a church in St. Louis that had a motto that was really something I thought was very good. It said, reach the lost, teach the found, in order that they all may become disciples of Christ. Now, isn't that pretty good?
Yeah, that is pretty good.
I think that summarized it pretty well in what we were doing. Now, I took the congregation and tried to be where they were, tried to adjust myself to mm-hmm. being the only Augustinian congregation, only one of three basically Swedish congregations in the whole area. But I'm trying to bring that into the mainstream of Christianity within the framework of the community. And that was made the second emphasis, and that was the fact that the church, in order to still live, to exist, mm-hmm. had to cooperate with other religious bodies. First of all, the Christians, but then the non-Christians too. Mm-hmm. You had to work with them all and be a part and parcel of what they were doing, bringing the influence of the Christian church on that which happens. And this idea today of teaching the church that wants to emphasize that they can go it alone, if you didn't agree with them, you weren't as good as they. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't go. I mean, you have different understandings of different things. And for that reason, you talk with people, not against them or not, anyway, you didn't set up a definitive program that excluded people.
Us and them.
Well, yeah, it wasn't us and them. It was no exclusionary thing. Mm-hmm. It was inclusion that you tried. And that's what you tried to do with the ecumenical movement. You still took care of your own. You still believed in the things that you believed in. But you worked with others who had convictions mm-hmm. that differed from yours. But nonetheless, they were convicted of what they believed. And so were you. But you still could work and care for the people in addition to those of yourselves.
Okay.
So.
So tell, this is a big Roman Catholic area.
Yeah.
And your relationship with the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
I think you made some real headroads with that.
Well, I think so. And a couple things worked out very well. The first person that I got acquainted with and to know to any great degree was Bishop Malone from the great Diocese of Youngstown. And he became a good friend. And in addition to that, helped me understand the dimensions of Roman Catholicism. In addition to him, there were others that I got to meet on the parish level who were also convinced that they were on the right path and that that was the way to go. And we still work together for the needs of the people. And I think probably we made some inroads. Basically, at the Ecumenical Coalition, mm-hmm. back in 1977 when the steel mills closed and had a great deal of that to concern ourselves with, when we talked about that, and at least two things came out of that, and we didn't accomplish the reopening of steel mills, but we did get, one, the basic Christian churches to talk to one another. Bishop Malone was the head of it, and there was one who was the jurisdictional leader of the various denominations, was also part of that major committee. Mm-hmm. But the minor committee were the rest of us that were in parishes and doing some work along that line. We did do a lot of work along that line. And the second thing that happened to that was that we got management and labor to consider conversation with one another so that they weren't of opposites, mm-hmm. Taking and saying the different voices that they had to speak. The same way with the clergy no one felt better than another one.
Okay.
But that was under the guidance of Bishop Malone, and man, he did a great job.
So I think we're kind of running out of time here, but I do want to ask, what is your greatest concern for church, faith, and people in the future, and what good do you think is still out there?
What good do I see? And let me take the second one first.
Okay.
was that the good is the ethics, the ethos of the Christian faith that helped to say you need to have consideration for your brothers and sisters' well-being. You need to talk about what needed when they needed help. And for example, in the black controversy, and we have to learn that we can not only get along, but we also work together, that kind of thing. And so there is the good of this sort of emphasis, the ethic that goes on and says, this is what we need to do, and this is why. And the why that we do it is because we are people of faith. Mm-hmm. And that is the reason that we are helping people and so forth. Other thing that I say that is good is the fact that the churches are no longer bound, be careful with this, however, are never bound to the size or dimensions of the building. Mm. And the modern church is going to look a lot different from what the church of today really believes. So I love to go into churches and see the old Gothic type churches. Those are fantastic, but they can't afford them anymore. Right. And even the mega churches don't do that anymore. So we have to think in terms of the kind of buildings that are going to be commensurate with the duties that we perform. Okay. And so I would say that there is the ethos that is still there and still correct. There's still 10 commandments. They help each other to live as they ought to. But there's also the prayer of the Lord's Prayer that helps strengthen each individual in the way in which they want to be. Mm-hmm. So they're going to do both.
Okay. What are you concerned about with the church in the future?
Oh, I'm concerned about people that want to have the emphasis on the crown of life and kind of forget the cross of Jesus. That they have the crown but no cross. Mm-hmm. And this whole business of making you feel well and feel better without reference to the ethics, with the suffering of Christ, this the minimizing of the cross and the maximizing of the crown, because you got to have the cross before you get the crown.
Okay.
And until I get that into balance and people are willing to do that, then I think you've got a lot of worry to come.
Okay. I think that's our time.
Oh, really?